Assalamu alaikum. You're listening to She Speaks Academic Muslimas. Today we'll be talking to Dr. Ilora Shehabuddin, who's a professor of Transnational Asian Studies and the core faculty in the Center of Study of Women, Gender and Sexuality at Rice University. She received her AB in Social Studies from Harvard and her PhD in Politics from Princeton University. Professor Shehabuddin is the author of Sisters in the Mirror, A History of Muslim Women and the Global Politics of Feminism that just came out with the University of California Press. She has also published Reshaping the Holy, Democracy, Development and Muslim Women in Bangladesh. Through her career, she has received many prestigious fellowships and she currently serves on the editorial board of Journal of Bangladesh Studies. In our conversation today, we talk about the stories of feminist struggles we tell ourselves, the actual historical studies that provide a more nuanced picture, the conversation between feminists from the West and Global South or transnational feminists, and why is it so hard to have the more difficult conversations needed within feminist struggles. Before we get started, I want to remind you to please subscribe to the podcast, leave a review, leave a comment, rate it, share it with your friends and family. And now we turn to Dr. Shehabuddin. Assalamu alaikum, Ilora.
Walaikum assalam, Sabah.
Thank you so much for doing this. I really, really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. I'm looking forward to this conversation with you. I'm really glad to be here.
Me too. And thank you for sending me your book. I'm just going to jump right in. I want to know a little bit about how you entered academia. What's your journey been like?
I think I was always interested in writing and teaching. It's embarrassing, but I remember, you know, playing teacher as a child, and I liked writing. You know, I'd write for local newspapers, etc. But I think when I went off to college, I came to the US for the first time. When I came to college, I wasn't thinking about academia. I was going to study economics, which is, I think, what most South Asians are supposed to do. Very practical. You come here if you're not doing, you know, engineering and other things. So you come here, you study economics. And I did enroll in an economics class, but then I discovered social studies, which is a special major in my college, and it required a senior thesis. And I loved that experience. I loved doing research. I got to travel back to Bangladesh to do some research. I enjoyed the writing. So for me, that was a phenomenal experience. And then I applied to graduate school, and I think I still wasn't sure that I wanted to be an academic, but I knew I didn't want to work out there. So grad school was good. And then while in graduate school, you know, you meet enough others who are more sure that they want to be academics, and it sounded great. So, you know, I went in, but even then I think I kept thinking, okay, if I don't get a job, I'll just quit and, I don't know, go open a small restaurant. Or if I don't get my first book out, I'll quit and I'll, you know, start a restaurant or something else. Or, you know, if I don't get tenure, but, you know, alhamdulillah, everything worked out. So here I am all these years later. It wasn't preordained, but it worked out.
What I really like about this journey is that, you know, a lot of people who enter grad school are so hung up on getting a TT job, like a tenure track job, that we feel like failures, anything short of that. And we look at it, even though we have PhDs in our hand, we're like, oh my God, like, you know, we didn't do well in life, even though I just went through a ton of grad school. And the fact that you didn't have that attitude is such an empowering attitude. I hope grad students who are listening take from that attitude and say, yeah, the journey itself is super valuable. And there are many, many careers outside of academia that one can be pursuing and should be pursuing.
I think it's harder now, right? It's harder to find those tenure track jobs. So I think I went through this in an easier time, for sure.
Definitely. It's only getting harder. I mentioned at the beginning that you sent me a copy of your book. I really appreciate it. It's an amazing book. I didn't get to read it cover to cover, but I read enough to realize that I should be reading it cover to cover. So I soon will be. And I think I can incorporate a lot in one of my classes as well. It's called Sisters in the Mirror, A History of Muslim Women and the Global Politics of Feminism. I wanted to ask you right off the bat, because I think the title itself, and I wish I could show the book picture. Maybe I'll make that the art cover. But it's basically two mannequins, I guess, of women that are constructed of mirrors facing each other. And I love it. I love the juxtaposition. I love the title. And I wanted to ask you, what did you mean by the title of the book? How did you arrive at it?
Thank you. Thank you. The book I've organized around travel and encounters. So some are stories of conflict, of, you know, Orientalism, condescension, colonialism, racism between Western-based feminists and feminists from Muslim countries. But I also have stories, and I've tried to include enough of both, and maybe more of the latter, stories of encounters that led writers from Britain, Bengal, and the United States to pause and think about things that were taken for granted in their own society, you know, ideas about women's rights and roles, for example. And the way I imagined it when I was, you know, writing about these encounters is that they look at another society and reflect about their own, right? They encounter things in these other societies or in these other men and women that makes them think about imperfections the way we do when we look at a mirror, basically. Right? We stare at a mirror long enough, we see all kinds of things that, oh, you know, this is right, or this is wrong, and that's wrong. I had the mirror image fixed, and I think the title was also done, and I was looking for an image, and then I found this sculpture by a Bangladeshi artist called Tayeba Begum Lippi. She'd created this sculpture, and I mean, in addition to the sculpture was this passage that she had written to go along with it. It's on the back of the book, and you or I could read it if you like.
Definitely. Please do read it.
I had the press reproduce it on the back. And so Lippi came up with this text to go with her art. I quote, "When I see things through my heart, when I have a conversation with another woman, or when I listen to someone's stories, I sometimes find the reflection of my own mind in that mind. We are as different as we live our lives, but we always find some similar issues or stories that are never spoken out ever. All of a sudden, one may find it is her own story, apparently expressed by the person she is listening to." End quote. Beautiful. By Tayeba Begum Lippi. So I think the image was perfect, and the title I thought just was a good reflection of these encounters and people looking at one another and thinking about their own situation.
Definitely. I mean, I think it encapsulates all the stories that you tell through the book. You know, one of the things I'm sure you might have encountered as you teach your undergrad students is that a lot of our students seem to think that the West has sort of kind of reached some kind of, well, maybe not gender equity, but at least they've reached a point that is close to gender equality, or closer than at least the global South. And so they think of it as like a linear kind of race. And then the West is very, very ahead. And then the global South, we're just learning from the West and kind of catching up. You kind of discuss this a little bit in the book. What do you see wrong with that particular picture? But more importantly, I also want to hear, like, how do you see it?
That's a good question. So I think one of the main problems with the idea of, you know, Western feminism having developed, and I think I even used the term, this idea that there's feminist nirvana in the West, having gotten to the end point or almost the end point, and then everyone else is catching up. It's the same argument that's often used for development, right? So countries are developing, or right, less developed or underdeveloped. So you're lesser feminist, you need to catch up on feminism. It's that sort of idea. So what I've tried to argue is that this image assumes that these two lines, if we want to think with these lines, are separate from one another. And what I'm trying to show is that they were always intertwined. That's why I do this long history. And so Western feminists thinking about their own conditions have defined, you know, from the very beginning, like Mary Wollstonecraft, in the context of relations with other countries. And the other argument often made is that, you know, the response from countries in the global South or Muslim societies is, no, we've had our own feminism from the very beginning, from, you know, 7th century Arabia. And of course, many important rights did become available at the dawn of Islam. But I think it is inaccurate to suggest that we were able to ourselves develop in isolation from the West, given, you know, the West's economic, political, military power over the last few centuries. So since I focus on Muslims here, Muslims have been in the difficult position of having to think about their rights and talk about them in the shadow of Western empire or imperial power and military and global economic and political power. So they haven't been able to just, you know, in a free floating way, say, okay, this is what we want and this is what we do. They've always had to contend with Western images about them, Western representations of them. And of course, the more solid material things like occupation, invasions, colonialism, etc.
Oftentimes global South feminists and transnational feminists as well say, no, we have our own struggles. We have our own version of feminism, independent, completely separate. And what you're arguing is that that's not possible because we interact constantly with one another through our history of colonialism and invasions and imperialisms and so on and so forth. Would that be an accurate description?
Yeah. So I think I would agree that absolutely that Global South feminists have their own priorities and agendas, but I think the slight difference would be that those agendas are necessarily affected by Western power. So I talk about the UN conferences of the late 20th century. Western feminists could talk about what they thought of as real women's issues.
Right.
Whereas the Global South feminists said, well, we can't just talk about women's issues because they're intricately connected to racism and occupation and, you know, colonialism. Mm-hmm. So for them, women's issues aren't these isolated things. So they had to contend with that. And Muslim women, for example, had also to contend with how do I talk about the problems in my own society, which of course there are many, when I might be providing fodder to anti-Muslim racism that exists in the West, right?
Definitely.
So they've had to negotiate that in a way that Western feminists, white Western feminists have not.
And so were there any examples that you found in your research that really surprised you or that spoke to you, resonated with you in terms of learning from one another and speaking to one another and being informed by one another?
Some, this long history, I think I was more gratified to see that there were these positive stories all along. Women like Mary Montagu from the early 18th century, who's been very well studied and written about, talks about how she was in a Turkish bathhouse, Ottoman bathhouse, and how the women looked at her. They gasped with horror, I think was sort of the language she used, on seeing her corset, right? Mm. So it's an interesting moment where, of course, you know, the Europeans had their ideas about Muslim women being veiled and secluded and all this stuff, even in the early 18th century. And she uses this moment where she's in the bathhouse and the women are very freely taking off their clothes to enjoy what the bathhouse has to offer. And so she, after much pressure, she talks, you know, she's being very modest in her retelling of this encounter, of this incident. She says, I take off my outer garments and then they see the corset and they're horrified. Wait, how does she put it? She, you know, they think this is a machine that my husband has locked me up in. So we don't know if it actually happened. You know, these so-called letters were always embellished and elaborated after the fact to get ready for publication, but she uses the context of the Turkish bathhouse in a way to offer a critique of Western women's dress at the time, right? So she does in a very interesting way, and many people have written about this. So my contribution here, I'd like to think, is more about putting it in this longer history of similar such examples, not sort of finding the story for the first time. So many, many people have written about this. So Mary Montagu's in the 18th century. Later in the 18th century, you have Mary Wollstonecraft, who's called the foremother of Anglo-American feminism. And even she makes her claims for, you know, English women deserve rights, deserve education along the lines of English men and boys, etc., by saying, look, we are English women. We are not like those women in the seraglios and the harems who have no souls, because that was a common idea at the time that Muslim women are believed not to have souls. So she says, we deserve rights because we're not like them. So we deserve education and this. So she didn't travel to any of these countries. She had no firsthand knowledge, but the idea was powerful enough and dominant enough at the time that it was not in question. She could just refer to Muslim women and seraglios, etc., and say, we're better than them, so we deserve rights. And then you move another century forward, late 19th century and early 20th, British women, American women asking for suffrage, for example, again, because they're better than the colonized men. Better than Black men. They see themselves as more deserving of suffrage than Black men in this country and colonized men elsewhere. So none of this happens in a vacuum, I guess, is the bigger message, right? They're always bringing in these examples from other countries or from people of color within their own societies to make their own demands for feminism.
Wow.
For rights.
Yeah. In your book, you have a specific focus that is on the Muslims of Bengal. Why that specific focus? And then also, why isn't that their specific focus in other works oftentimes that we see when people, because some of your examples are from the time of partition. And oftentimes when we read about the history of the partition of the Indian subcontinent, people tend to generally focus on Uttar Pradesh, or they focus on Punjab areas. They talk about Lahore, they'll talk about Delhi, or just that specific area. And then the rest kind of gets sidetracked. So why do you think generally there is not that focus? And then why did you decide to have that focus?
I think part of it is, you know, Muslims are associated with Arabic, so the Arab world, and the larger Middle East, which include Turkey and Iran, get more attention. So there's a great deal of scholarship about Muslim women in that part of the world. So South Asia has received generally less attention than the Arab world, even though numerically there are many more Muslims in South Asia, and of course, many more in Southeast Asia. So part of it was to redress that gap, that lag, sort of highlight what's happening in South Asia. And then within South Asia, as you point out, I wanted to focus on Bengal because, again, I think it has to do with language. Urdu is seen as a more Islamic language than Bengali, right? And we know that also from the history of 1947 to 71, Urdu is seen, because it's written in the Arabic script, it's closer to Persian, it's seen as more Muslim. And so that's gotten more attention. So when there is work on Muslims in South Asia, it's focused on, you know, Northern India and Urdu texts, of course, and there's more work on Muslims in Bengal. And I think that's important. On the partition question, I think partition was much more violent and dramatic, and the violence was dramatic on the Punjab side. So there's a reason that the Bengali side, I think that's the usual reason the Bengali side hasn't gotten as much attention, you know, the dramatic, the horrific scenes of the trains, etc. I think there wasn't anything on that scale on the Bengal side. Partition in Bengal was, you know, Bengal was also partitioned, but I think it was slower. It didn't happen, you know, like overnight or over a number of weeks. It continued into the 50s. So for the moment of partition, at least, the partition in Bengal played out very differently from partition in Punjab.
Definitely, yeah. Actually, I'd never thought of violence aspect in terms of Bengal before. So that's a really interesting point for me to learn and look up further. Towards the end of your book, you talk about something that I've also written about a little bit, which is how, and a lot of other Global South feminists have kind of written about, which is the way that certain feminists, I don't want to say from the Global South, because they're not technically from the Global South. They're more like second generation. They're more like my kids. They're kind of growing up here. But feminists like Ian Ali Hirshi or Shad Manji or Taslima Nasreen, how these feminists kind of get uptake in Western media.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe you can also give a little bit of context to who these people are, because I think we kind of, at least I kind of remember them post 9/11 era.
Right.
But maybe for the newer generation, these names have less meaning, hopefully. But then you have another set of feminists who are actually doing work on the ground that you also kind of shed light on. And why do one set of feminists get so much uptake, so much airtime, and then the other set, not so much at all?
Very good question. So I started thinking about this book in the years just after 9/11, 2001, and the invasion and occupation of Afghanistan and Iraq, when there was a lot of attention to the plight, the oppressed lives of Muslim women, and they were oppressed by Islam was the argument, right? We're not oppressed by war, by occupation, by bombardment, by economic conditions created by war and bombardment, but by Islam, right? Islam was the villain and we needed to rescue them from it. As is well known, Laura Bush gave that famous radio speech about how we're going into Afghanistan to rid the women of these oppressive blue burqas, etc. So this was the context in which I started thinking about this. And that's when the writers you mentioned, Ayaan Hirsi Ali and Ishad Manji, for example, most prominently really, appeared. And there were several others too. And they were very eager to speak out against misogyny in the Muslim world. And they were very quickly embraced and celebrated by the mainstream media and by prominent publishers as the real feminists of Islam. I mean, I remember articles from the New York Times, etc., calling them, you know, these are the true feminists.
I think Ishad Manji even received some award from Oprah. She was on Oprah. I think she was even called to my campus as a representative of Islam.
And yeah.
Muslim Student Association was like, what is happening?
Right, right. In that first decade, both of these, you know, burst onto the scene and rose to prominence. And I think what was interesting is that almost without exception, these two women, plus the others who emerged, I mean, really, Brigitte Gabriel, Noni Darwish, I mean, there were several of these people, book, you know, authors who just published, I think, best-selling books very quickly. But each of these writers combined their calls for reform in Muslim communities with very warm, even vigorous support for the U.S. government's domestic and foreign policies at the time in Iraq and Afghanistan, for example, but also against Muslims in the U.S. So I think I would locate their uptake, as you put it, to that, right? They were going along with current policies. And so they were seen as supportive of those policies, saying the right things about both Islam and Muslims, and also about government policies overseas and here. So I think that it made sense, right? And people have talked about how, you know, what academics call discourse works. If it fits within the frame, it's much easier to accept it. Whereas when someone says something that makes you pause and think, you're like, wait, you know, I haven't heard that as many times, so it can't be true.
Right.
So I think that's a lot of what happened. And of course, many people, many of our colleagues and, you know, other scholars in the field quickly responded to challenge these women when they claim to be spokespersons for Muslim women globally. Our colleagues also challenged this new trope of the oppressed Muslim woman. As I was thinking about this, you know, there are two questions that had been niggling away. One was the issue of the double bind, right? So here are these women who are getting a great deal of fame and attention because they're willing to go along with U.S. government policy. So my first question was, well, how historically have Muslim writers and activists negotiated having to point out the very real problems in their communities without colluding with larger political forces, right?
Yeah.
Which were claiming to save or civilize their societies, or in modern parlance, without giving fodder to anti-Muslim rhetoric. So that was one question I was very interested in. And then the second one, which I think is exactly what you're asking, who gets authorized to speak on behalf of Muslim women? Why were these the ones selected and so celebrated? So that's when I decided, okay, I can make a whole book out of this by doing a longer historical study, because we needed one, and to see how things had changed. Because one of the things that many colleagues said is, you know, the West has always seen Muslim women as oppressed. And what I found by doing the longer study is that how the West viewed Muslim women depended very much on the nature of the political relationship. So before Europeans were engaged in colonialism in South Asia, the Europeans were the supplicants. They wanted the Mughal emperor to recognize them and give them the right to set up a factory here or to trade there, right? So at the time, they weren't describing women, Muslim women, as oppressed.
Right.
And to become the colonial power, that the arrogance comes in and power comes in. And their ideas about women also start to change.
Yeah.
You know, through all the centuries, I am interested in how the larger political context shapes the representation.
I mean, could you also shed a little bit of light on the other set of feminists, the intersectional feminists that you mentioned towards the end as well?
Yeah. So you have these two, and then you have Taslima Nasreen, who came to global prominence before 9/11. And she's very different from them. She, you know, she doesn't write in English. She writes in Bengali, which then has to be translated. She didn't emerge in the post 9/11 world. So I think that explains. And she didn't speak out in favor of US policy in the same way. So I think she's gotten less attention than them in many ways. And then the ones I talk about at the end of the book, it's called the Bangladeshi Feminist Collective in New York. It's a large group, but I mentioned three of them, Shantali Haque, Shahana Hanif, and Zaitun Maryam, who are doing very serious feminist and activist work on the ground. They ask hard questions about intersectionality. They mobilize people for movements, for elections, for community work. And just like the other feminists who are completely left out of the books of Irshad Manji and Ayan Hirsi Ali, these women don't get the same kind of attention because they're asking these hard questions and doing real work. Shahana Hanif just got elected to the New York City Council. I have that right. So, and, you know, the others are very active in their own context. So, again, I think it goes back to when you ask hard questions about intersectionality being missing from this context and that context, there's no easy message for the press and everyone else to just gather around and say, oh, look, this is so easy and exactly what we want to hear. So I think that explains part of that.
Yeah, the part of the problem, definitely. You're getting to the crux of not only how some dominant narratives see transnational feminists, but also why it is so difficult to capture the more nuanced picture, why it's so difficult to capture when somebody is doing real intersectional work that talks to war, that talks to imperialism, to colonialism, to inner city politics, and so on and so forth. So I think that's a really important point. Well, thank you so much, Alora. I mean, this has been a very, very enlightening interview, but also I recommend everybody to please get this book, Sisters in the Mirror, because it's a fabulous argument backed by a ton of good historical examples. And so I recommend everybody to go out and get this book.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you.
Me too. Thank you so much for coming on. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam. Bye-bye.